You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network.
What happened? It's right before Christmas. Come on.
Rocking around the Christmas tree at the Christmas party hop. Mistletoe.
Yeah.
You can see every couple tries to stop. Rocking around the Christmas tree, let the Christmas spirit ring. Later we'll have some pumpkin pie and we'll do some caroling. You will get a sentimental feeling when you hear voices singing, let's be jolly, deck the halls with boughs of holly.
Born and wake up. Yeah. How about that? Christmas upon us. The weekend will come and the weekend will go. And yeah, Santa is on his way. How about that? Yeah, it's crazy how that happens every year. So we should do a Christmas show, right? Or two. It's the 20th of December, in case you haven't looked up yet.
In the new old-fashioned way.
Yeah, good morning to you on a, on a Friday morning. Yeah, my sound effects. How about that? Yeah, the record scratch. Love that. Yeah, I had to start a folder now that I have the record scratch in there. The other one is obviously the most prolific one out of all of them is this. The rim shot. Yeah, you have to have that when you say, yeah, when you say things, you know, that are totally absurd, that border on comedy, which happen on this program every day. So anywho, good morning to you. On this, the last Friday before Christmas, the weekend, and then you have Monday and Tuesday, and then the big day is upon us. So anyway, hope you have all your shopping done. If not, get out there and don't be afraid to mix it up in the crowds at the mall. It's always a good time. You have people out there desperate to buy things, and a lot of men are last minute shoppers, which I'm fond of. So yeah. So, yeah, Merry Christmas to everybody out there. And I watched the second half of It's a Wonderful Life last night. Picked up right where George was headed. He had just kind of thrown his hissy fit at his house. And he pissed off his wife and his kids. And the lovely Donna Reed obviously knows something's wrong. George wasn't, you know, behaving like his normal self. And then he leaves, right? And then he crashes into the tree. And then he gets out and he goes into Martini's bar. All right, so that's kind of where it started. And I even turned the subtitles on because I wanted to know what George was saying. You know, he's at the bar, right, and he orders a drink, and he's kind of mumbling into his hands. And I didn't know if I ever really understood what he said, but he's talking to God, right, about, you know, please help me. I know I'm not a praying man, blah, 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 blah. And so I watched that. And I don't it's probably my favorite movie of all time. And I don't know, I think, like everybody, the part, you know, where while he's contemplating suicide, his better half, Mary, she goes to the community. And she tells people, hey, George needs help. And then everybody shows up. Right? Everybody shows up. And so so it's an awesome movie. And again, I was watching the 4K colorized version. And I would tell you that it's better than the black and white. And it's better than the original lame-ass colorized version of it. I loved it. I like it better than the black and white. But some people say, oh, the black and white. Whoa. But if you see, again, the technology that's used now to colorize old movies is pretty amazing. And again, I referred to it yesterday, but if you haven't seen, They Will Never, what's the name of the World War One movie? They Will Never Die? Something like that. Anyway, that dude, what he did, and it's that technology that they use, what he did with old black and white footage is absolutely amazing, right? Slowed it down from, you know how it's like, why did World War One soldiers walk so fast? Well, they really didn't, right? It was the speed they took the film at. Yeah, because those guys, they look like they're hauling ass every time they're walking someplace. And they really weren't. But that's the speed of the film. So he slows it down to normal, right? And then they digitally colorize it in the process that he uses. And honestly, it's stunning. Absolutely, positively stunning. And so I would tell you, if you haven't seen the digital colorized version of the digital colorized version of It's a Wonderful Life, it is worth your, they shall not grow old. They shall not die. Something like that, right? That's from George Mendoza, Lieutenant GPD. I watched that last night to get in the Christmas spirit. And again, I can never watch that without tearing up. And you, I don't know what's, to me, I don't know, and I was thinking about it last night, well, what exactly tears me up about this movie? And to me, it's, you know, he's in this place. He's in this alone place. You know, I could like it to post-traumatic winning, right? His behavior, right? He's, George is a strong guy in his community, and he's a proud guy, but he's frustrated, right? He never got to go to college. He never got to build skyscrapers. He never got to go around the world. Every time he tries to go around the world, something happens. And his brother goes to college. He gets married. And then there's a run on the bank that day. And so, you know, George has his demons. And then on a particularly bad day, right before Christmas, enabled by alcohol, right? He winds up on a bridge contemplating his own death, and then Clarence shows up. So anyway, I don't know what it is about the movie that touches me. And I was trying to quantify. I was thinking about that last night, but I think it's the scene at the end when she's standing there, right? And she comes running in the house with her coat on, and she pulls that table, and then she like throws everything off the table, and she goes, "George will never believe it." And then people start coming in the house, right? And to include his parents' old housekeeper, you know. I saved this money up for a divorce in case I ever get married. And she throws her money in, which is a great line. And you see the community rally around this guy. And so it's an incredible story. I mean, it's a story of redemption, right? And it's a story of asking for help in a dark time. And but I think it's she does that, right? And then he looks at her. And she has this incredible, Donna Reed's obviously a beautiful woman, but she has this incredible, you know, look on her face, right? And it's that moment with all those people piling through. And I guess you know, I always call those moments good on top of good on top of good on top of good on top of good, you know, and those things are sown by a life of doing good. So, yeah, my favorite movie. So, anyway, not to be confused with They Shall Not Grow Old. But again, if you haven't seen it, it doesn't look like some hokey ass version of a black and white movie. Yeah, it's very good. The Chef Kent isn't going to join us today, but Montana Man is going to join us. So Montana Man is, Dash 2. He's the chef understudy. Yeah, for All Marine Radio. So, and he's a legit chef, but he's kind of more of a Western chef guy. So you're going to, when we talk about food, you're going to hear, Montana Man say, even on stuff like when I think of barbecue, I think of wet barbecue. He doesn't think of wet barbecue. He thinks of dry barbecue. So you're going to hear us talk a little bit about food today, so we'll do that. But I don't really want to go through the news today because it always sucks so much, right? And you know, today's not going to be any exception, okay? It won't be. So I don't – what I want to play for you is something that somebody is something that somebody sent me. And so somebody who listens and said, you know, I'm going to send you this, and I know you're going to be, I'm not going to exactly use the phraseology he raised. He said, but you're going to be very excited. He said, what this is by the guy who wrote The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors that we were talking about yesterday, which is the Battle of Leyte Gulf. And in particular, I was corrected numerous times yesterday for mixing a couple of different stories. Okay? And one of the stories is about, hold on, let me find it. The USS, somebody, Ohio man sends me an email later in the day. He's like, dude, you're an idiot. You interviewed the authors of Lucky 666 on your program. We were talking about the book yesterday, and I didn't even remember. I remembered the story, and I remembered pieces of the story. It should have dawned on me, like, how would I know these things had I not, right, done something with it? But that really did not go into my head. Yeah. So, anyhow, I said, don't be a hater, man. Right? Obviously, they were underwhelming if I didn't even remember the interview. So we were talking about Adam Makos, who's written a book called Devotion, who's written a book called A Higher Calling, I think. And that was a book about the German Messerschmitt's a pilot who did not shoot down the B-17, and then they meet after the war. Yeah, it's a pretty cool story. There's a and the coolest part is a picture in there. So you see these two guys standing in the center of the picture with their wives, and then you see the crew of the B-17. You see their families and their grandkids. All these all this happens because of what that guy did that day. But anyway, those things came up talking about the last stand of the Tin Can Sailors, and so the Native American skipper was Captain Evans. He was the skipper of the USS Johnston. He made the original turn into the Japanese fleet, and he was the one that was the recipient of the Medal of Honor, not the guy on the Samuel B. Roberts. Yeah. So anyway, it was Evans. Yeah, and in fact, I want to see, I got another email about Evans later in the day. And I got this about Hal and Matt Smith. You were talking about Hal and Matt Smith. World War II is definitely a different time, and our leaders were certainly human. On February 5, 1943, Smith was arrested for hit and run and drunk driving, but the charges were promptly dropped. Smith was observed sideswiping another car about 3 miles from where a jaywalker had his leg broken by a hit and run driver, and it is not clear either that Smith was that driver or that he had been drinking excessively. Smith rarely drank heavily, and the combination of wartime blackout and Smith's fatigue seems sufficient to explain the incident. I don't think that would suffice these days. Yeah. And then this. In your discussion of Copeland at Lady Gulf, you were trying to explain the exploits of Commander Ernest Evans of the USS Johnston. Evans was an American Indian. See? I knew that. And he was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions at Samar after leading the charge of the American destroyers. When the Japanese fleet during the battle off Samar was first sighted, Evans did not hesitate. He ordered his helm sharp to port, and he led his destroyer out of the task unit's circular anti-aircraft disposition in favor of charging the enemy alone to make a torpedo attack. Than this. Read the interview with a surviving officer from the USS Johnston. He said that when the Japanese were sighted and the large caliber shells started falling, Evans immediately ordered full speed ahead and to make smoke, and then left full rudder to head straight towards the enemy fleet. He said when he heard the command, left full rudder, this is the officer talking, not Evans, obviously, who died. Who was killed in action. He said when he heard the command, left full rudder, he wondered how his mother would react when she got the telegram announcing his death. Evans was a veteran of the disaster at the Java Sea. When he took command of the Johnston, he told the crew he intended to take the ship in harm's way, and any of the crew who wanted to transfer could. No one took him up on the offer, and October 25th, 1944, Evans fulfilled his promise. So you're going to hear the guy who writes Last Stand of Tin Can Sailor. You're going to hear a speech that he gave about it here in a few minutes. So you're going to hear that instead of the news. Something inspirational instead of something more based in the depressing reality in the world we live in today. So, good morning to you. Whitney Houston's going to sing the national anthem here on a Friday, as she normally does. Hope you're having a Merry Christmas. And for those of you who celebrate Happy Holidays, all of that to you. She makes it official on this Friday morning. Good morning to you. And this is dedicated to everybody. Have a Merry Christmas. All of you who listen to make All Marine Radio part of your day, certainly appreciate that. And thank you very much for doing that. Thank you very much for touching other people's lives and all the cool stuff that that happens because you do. So this is dedicated to everybody who listens to All Marine Radio, and I hope that all y'all have a Merry Christmas. And again, for those of you who do the Happy Holiday thing, Happy Holidays.
You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You gotta win.
Time to check the weather. To include shithole weather. Oh. On a Friday. Currently it is. You know, if I don't sound right in my head, then I can't do the show. There's a certain way that my voice sounds in my head, and when it ain't like that, did you hear me just stutter a second ago? That's because it wasn't right in my head. And there's a whole variety of reasons why it might not be right. But anyway, yeah, I can't do the show. I can't do it. Anyway, currently it is sunny and 37 in Quantico. It is sunny and 48 in North Carolina and at Camp Lejeune. It is sunny and 44 in 29 Palms. It is sunny and 50 at Camp Pendleton, so cold on the West Coast. Camp Smith in Hawaii has 5 weather warnings. I'm trying to think what's the most we've ever had. I think Okinawa had 8 once. So, Camp Smith in Hawaii, or not just Camp Smith, but for the Hawaiian Islands. High wind warning, a wind advisory, gale warnings. Isn't a gale warning included in the high wind warning? Warning, right? Means are they real? Advisory, right? Not so much. So, gale warning in effect. small craft advisory, and a high surf advisory. All of that. Yeah, all of that. Further to the west we go, Okinawa. It is dark, cloudy, and 65 in Okinawa. In Lashkar Gah in the Helmand province, it is clear, dark, and 44, so they're into the 40s early in the evening. And in Ramadi, it is, you know, they have half time zones in the world. Did you know that? Yeah. It's not all 1 hour jump. Some places in the world, they like have a half hour jump. Now, I don't know whose idea that was, but I think that's kind of stupid. Anyhow, in Ramadi, in Iraq, we head further southwest. It is clear, dark, and 54 degrees. That is a look at the weather here. No, it's not a look at the weather. Here at the Costa Mesa Newport Beach corporate headquarters of All Marine Radio, it is partly cloudy and 49 degrees. Looking for a high of 73, according to this. We shall see. And tomorrow, 73. Sunday, 68. Well, how about that? It was supposed to be colder sooner. The 10-day forecast calls for 59 degrees. Damn it. On Monday, with rain. 61 on Tuesday, 59 on Wednesday, 60 on Thursday. That's outrageous. Who the hell thought that was a good idea? All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, you're going to hear a little talk. And we talked about the book, The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors, and how it kind of got introduced to All Marine Radio and some of the things that happened. You're going to hear from the author who wrote it. Yeah, you're going to hear a little bit from him, and I'll butt in while he's talking, always. And then Montana Man joins us. He's pinch hitting for the chef who's got his back is at it again. So, don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
A message from DAV to all returning veterans. Thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding. Thank you for laying it all on the line. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting your future on hold to put our enemies on notice. Thank you for putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way. Thank you for defending our freedom, for displaying your honor, for being a hero, even though you don't want to be called one. For all this and more, DAV thanks you. And we're here to help you. Expert DAV advisors will make sure you get the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in the crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I wanna walk into a cold, bitter ocean, feel the sting of letting go of all hope and so be made.
Yeah, Merry Christmas to Peyton Davis. Yeah. I wonder if she has a Christmas carol. I need to call her. Hey, Peyton, you got a Christmas carol that I can play on Monday? All right, so what I want to do is I want to play for you a little audio, okay? And so you're going to hear the introduction done at, this is Vice Admiral Ted Carter. Vice Admiral is a 3-star, right? He's the 62nd superintendent of the U.S. Naval Academy. This is in 2014 at a history conference, right? And so you're going to hear about this. So let me get out of the way. Stand by.
So my first task here is to introduce our first speaker. Now, Jim Hornfisher, for those of you who are students and folks who love history, certainly know who he is. He's written 3 major works. The 2 previous that he's done before his most recent one, The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors, The Extraordinary World War II Story of the U.S. Navy's Finest Hour, and Ship of Ghosts, the story of the USS Houston, FDR's legendary of lost cruiser, and the epic saga of her survivors, were recently published not too long ago. His writing career has grown out of a lifelong interest in the Pacific War, much of which you'll hear about today. He's appeared on many television shows from Fox News, the History Channel, Fox News War Stories with Oliver North, and C-SPAN's Book TV. He's a frequent speaker on the subject of war in the Pacific, and he's done many events here for our United States Navy and across the United States. He's a native of Massachusetts, a graduate of Colgate, and also got his higher education degree at the University of Texas School of Law. He's a member of the Naval Order of the United States, the Navy League, and catch this, he was appointed by Texas Governor Rick Perry as an admiral in the Texas Navy. So I'm hoping he'll tell us a little bit about what those duties and responsibilities of being an admiral in the Texas Navy are. He's a former New York book editor. He's the president of the literary agency Hornfisher Literary Management, located in Austin, Texas, where he lives with his wife and three children. His son David is here with us today. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm Annapolis welcome to the author of Neptune's Inferno, the U.S. Navy at Guadalcanal, James D. Hornfisher.
Thank you so much. Well, I didn't realize we were going to be talking about the threat of Mexican coastal raiders in my capacity as an admiral in the Texas Navy, but really it gets you invited to some pretty good cocktail parties in Austin. That's about all it is. Truly, it's a great honor to be here to tell a story that never gets old in the telling, and to tell it here in your company. It's a privilege and an opportunity and an honor. So thank you for that. Thank you, Admiral Carter. Thank you, Admiral Daly and the Naval Institute, Naval Academy, and welcome esteemed conferees. Now, later today on the stage over here, there's going to be a panel of men who served this country with true distinction. And as one who has never worn the uniform, when I stand here, I kind of feel a little bit like the bat boy who was asked to come bat leadoff for the 1927 Yankees. They're historic figures, combat veterans whose stories and lessons will resonate with you in ways I cannot guess. I think each of you will respond to something different in their experiences. And I really don't know of a way, this is an institution of higher learning, I don't know of a way for anybody to learn how to do the kinds of things that these men did. Now, as of this morning, and I did check, the Navy has yet to stand up ComNav Hero Pack. There is no Nav Skull Medal of Honor Lance. And there's certainly no way to know in advance what any of us might be capable of doing in a situation such as these men faced. All we can do is hear their stories, reckon with them in private moments, perhaps, and appreciate the willpower and the fortitude that they used to find a way through an impossible situation, to finish a mission, to save lives, perhaps, and to do some service to their country. So we'll start the day today with a story from World War II of a humble destroyer captain who, off Leyte in the Philippines in 1944, charged oblivion head-on. Captain Ernest E. Evans played a central, inspiring role in really what's the greatest major surface action in naval history. In it, 23 Japanese warships, including 12 battleships and cruisers, squared off against a utility task unit of escort carriers, destroyer escorts, and destroyers. They were defending the U.S. Army's five-day-old beachhead at Leyte in the Philippines. And all that stood against this powerful Japanese force was Admiral Clifton Sprague's task unit, known to history now as Taffy 3, task unit 77.4.3. The single largest of the Japanese ships, the mighty Yamato, weighed as much as all 13 American ships combined. She was a monster. On the day of battle, we're here to talk about Commander Ernest E. Evans, captain of the Fletcher-class destroyer USS Johnston. On the day of battle, he's 36 years old. He hails from Muskogee, Oklahoma, and his heritage is Cherokee and Creek Indian. He enlisted in 1926, spent a year in the Navy, and then took a commission here, arrived here in Annapolis in 1927, earning his commission in June of 31. Now, 10 years in the fleet saw a familiar rotation of junior officer billets and destroyers, cruisers, battleships, transports, the whole range of surface ships. And the day of the Pearl Harbor attack sees him on board the old Four Piper USS Alden. She served with the doomed U.S. Asiatic Fleet in the Dutch East Indies, and he would command that ship for more than a year before reporting to Seattle Tacoma to take command of the new USS Johnston, DD-557. As twilight breaks off Samar on the morning of October 25th, Evans takes his crew through the daily routine, morning general quarters. The jeep carriers launch their ASW patrols. And at 0643, one of these planes, a TBF Avenger flown by Bill Brooks, reports a large formation of enemy ships. The first thought is, it's Halsey. They're closing at 30 knots, range is 20 miles. And the men of Taffy 3 are duly surprised to see the horizon flashing silently with the report of heavy gunfire, Japanese capital ships opening fire at long range. Taffy 3 is in a standard cruising anti-aircraft cruising disposition, a circle, a little cluster of jeep carriers with a ring of escorts surrounding them. And Rear Admiral Sprague orders his ships to turn east immediately into the wind. Orders them to make smoke, orders all carriers to launch planes, and soberly calculates that he might have 15 minutes to go before, if he's lucky, he'll be enjoying a nice swim in the Philippine Sea. His jeeps can make 17 knots. His pursuers can make 27 to 30. Commander Evans and his destroyer, as you'll see in the next slide, are on the trailing part, the edge of the circular disposition, fleeing east, the Japanese bearing down from 315 true. Now, at this point in his career, Ernest Evans is a product of many things. He's a product of life on the Oklahoma Indian Territory, which nurtured his ambition to escape into a wider world. He's a product of the Naval Academy, where he learned the pride of sea service. And he's the product of 18 years in the fleet, to be sure. But perhaps the most important thing he's been influenced by is his recent combat experience in the Java Sea. In February of 1942, as I indicated, he was on board the USS Alden. And he never forgot how the four stacker's engines weren't powerful enough to hold that ship and her company at the head of the formation as Admiral Carl Dorman took it into battle in the Battle of Java Sea against Japanese cruisers. She was too slow to make an effective torpedo run. They tried, they fired, they ran low on fuel, and they were forced to withdraw in the face of an overwhelming enemy. And he remembered the sting of having to retreat as a loser. And that experience stayed with him. He carried this experience back stateside. And when the USS Johnson was commissioned at SeaTac in October of 1943, he evoked that memory. He told his crew that this would be a fighting ship and that he would not back down from the enemy. He further invited anyone who wanted no part of this to leave. Now, I don't know if this is boilerplate on commissioning day. I suspect it's said from time to time. The distinction today, on this day, was Evans meant it. And confronted with this overwhelming force on October 25th, Captain Evans demonstrates the meaning of a promise. He comes out of his sea cabin and coolly issues a series of commands, and there's no hesitation in his voice, according to witnesses. All hands to general quarters, prepare to attack a major portion of the Japanese fleet, all engines ahead flank, make smoke, stand by for torpedo attack, and the killer, left full rudder. Left full rudder puts him directly on course to the onrushing Japanese. A 2,100-ton destroyer against the world. The screen commander and the destroyer USS Hull has issued no commands as yet. Evans is acting entirely on his own. And in the reunions I attended, I heard a range of opinions about this decision, this life-or-death decision. Some of the guys weren't so happy to be carried toward the enemy like this. But that's the thing about the Navy. It's not like an infantry platoon. You don't have any choice but where the captain chooses to steer. So the carriers get about 25 minutes, Sprague's jeeps, to get their planes aloft before he has to turn out of the wind in favor of an escape course to the south. The pilots who get airborne are armed not for attacking ships, but for troop support. They've got fragmentation bombs, the usual loadout of 50 caliber ammunition, and no heavy ordnance, no torpedoes, no 500-pound armor piercers. With no time to form up, they rendezvous as best they can and set out after the fleet. Within minutes, they're on top of their targets. Now, Evans has conned the Johnston out from the circular disposition and is charging the Japanese alone, bone and teeth, 30 knots. He'll have to cross several miles of shell-torn ocean under fire from cruisers, battleships, the entire works, before he can do anything with his own 5-inch battery. The range of that battery is about 18,000 yards, but it's the torpedoes that will tell. His gunnery officer, Lieutenant Bob Hagen, mutters to himself, "Please, Captain, let's not go down without firing our torpedoes. To do that, he'll have to get within 10,000 yards. So we have a race against time and distance. Evans has the ship zigzagging, chasing salvos, counting on the Japanese to correct their aim to his previous position. He's chasing salvos, hoping they'll continue this predictable doctrine of applying spots and new ranges. And the Johnson comes within range, finally, of a Japanese cruiser, 18,000 yards. Lieutenant Hagen closes the firing key, tracking through his sighting telescope, and opens fire. Hagen's five crews in the single-mount 5-inch keep a ladder of shells tearing up a 200-yard stretch of sea projected across the path of the cruiser's advance. When Hagen sees the flashes in the upper superstructure indicating hits, he tightens that ladder to 100 yards. By his account, his gunners land some 40 hits on the Japanese cruiser, the IJN Kumano. The range closes, 15, 12, 10, and the torpedoes at last can be fired. The twin quintuple mounts train out, 10 fish leap into the water, hot, straight, and normal, beginning their countdown. Evans throws the helm hard over to port, his mission done, and will attempt to rendezvous with the carriers who are pounding south, fleeing for their lives. It's about 7:30 in the morning when the Johnson takes her first hits. The impact of it seems to shove the destroyer sideways, Lieutenant Hagen will report. All across the Johnson's 376-foot length, men are knocked off their feet. This salvo comes from a battleship, probably the Congo. It was like a puppy being smacked by a truck, Hagen would write. The salvo falls in a ripping arc and tears through the main deck, penetrating into the after engine room and exploding against the reduction gears. The after fire room takes one of the shells, and what the shells fail to do instantly, release super-pressured, high-temperature steam from shattered boiler pipes does with considerably less subtlety and mercy. Not a man in the after fire room survives this. And with this hit, one engine goes out, and the Johnson's speed is cut in half from 36 knots to about 17 to 18. There's a sound like a whole load of sheet metal dropping off onto a hard floor, and the Johnson takes a salvo from a smaller caliber, perhaps the secondary battery of the Yamato, perhaps a light cruiser, 6-inch shells. These shells hit below the director platform, twisting it upwards around the stack, and also strike the port bridge wing. Now, the blast of the bridge all but undresses Captain Evans. It blows the cap from his head and tears the shirt from his chest. 40-millimeter anti-aircraft rounds are set popping in the ready storage, and he takes shrapnel to the face, neck, head, and torso. The medical officer of the Johnston, Lieutenant Robert Brown, comes to assess him, and Evans says, "Don't bother with me now. Help some of those guys who are hurt." Evans was still in charge, coolly so, seemingly unbothered by the fact that two fingers from his hand are gone. His well-kept pilot house has been turned into a dirty meat locker. It's defiled by ghastly human wreckage. Fearing the sight of the carnage, thinking it might hurt morale, he orders one of his officers to start tossing the stuff overboard. And then he orders everybody off the bridge. The crew of the Johnston learn in an instant that shrapnel comes in many sizes, some large enough to cut limbs, some of it fine and particulate like a hot driving mist. They learn that shells tumbling through layers of steel generate noxious gases, and that a cascade of flames can douse you like liquid or kill you with shock. This is what Captain Evans had promised his men at Seattle-Tacoma. This was what going in harm's way entailed. Now, Bob Hagen's on his sound-powered phones checking his guns. He pulls the crew, all stations, control, testing, and back come the reports. Gun 1, aye. Gun 2, aye. Gun 3, aye. Gun 5, aye. Plot, aye. Hagen is relieved to hear he's not alone, but he wonders after gun number 4. It's gun captain Bob Hollenbaugh. Finally calls from a different station aft. His gun lost power and comms, and he's asked permission to fire in local control. Hagen approves the request, and Hollenbaugh declares his own war on the Japanese. Now, it seems, meanwhile, that these torpedoes that have been cruising north, at least one or two of them find their mark. Between squalls and smoke, Lieutenant Ellsworth Welch was watching the cruiser they'd been targeting. He sees a bright flash and the long form of the elegant Japanese ship kind of heave out of the water. The crippled cruiser falls out of line, limping along at half speed. The Johnston has scored. Now, along the way, Admiral Sprague as well has ordered, finally, his screen to attack. The hull, the Heerman, Samuel B. Roberts, pull out of the in-aircraft disposition, form up in column, and head in toward the Japanese. Heading north, they cross paths with the Johnston, coming south, returning to rendezvous. And they are stunned at how badly she's been hit. The main mast has been canted down across the bridge. Gun shields are ripped away, blackened, buckled, and torn. By any measure, the ship is entitled to call it a day. But Evans has a different understanding of his duty. As the other crews watch dumbstruck, Evans throws over the rudder, takes his limping ship, falls in astern the little charging DE, Samuel B. Roberts, and goes in to lend gunfire support to their torpedo run. He's having a second run at the Japanese. Now, we're about 45 minutes into this fight now, and the Naval High Command, you might say, is in a stir. Vice Admiral Thomas Kincaid, commander of the 7th Fleet, is making plain language calls on the radio to Halsey, asking for assistance. In time, Admiral Nimitz at Pearl Harbor will intercept some of these and ask Halsey about the whereabouts of the battleships, which he had thought were defending San Bernardino Strait. Halsey whips his baseball cap to the deck of his flagship, the battleship New Jersey. He's way up to the north, chasing the spotting of Japanese carriers, long his dream all through the war to reckon with the Japanese naval air arm. He finally orders his battleships to make course south, but it will be far too late. The little ships of Taffy 3 will be the sole owners of their fight for survival, supported by the next Taffy group to the south of them. Of course, Taffy 2 was launching aircraft, but Taffy 3 is in this alone. Third Fleet will play no part. By the time the Hull, Heerman, and Samuel B. Roberts reach torpedo range, the battle has devolved into a street fight. The hobbled Johnston is caught between a Japanese heavy cruiser column and a squadron of destroyers off to its west. When Captain Evans sees the destroyers are actually closing Sprague's carriers, he changes course and orders Hagen to engage them. The Johnston's guns keep up a rapid fire into 7,500 yards, and Hagen's pleased to see hits on the leading ship, a light cruiser, the squadron flagship. Hagen watches in astonishment as the ship, the Ahagi, turns away. He swivels his gun director to the next ship in line, a destroyer, and opens fire. That ship turns away, and on down the column, engaging, firing, taking hits, and firing some more. The destroyers turn away. The captain of Gun 5 on the Fantail, a sailor from Texas by the name of Clint Carter, screams down to the handling room, "More shells! More shells!" And one of his gang grumbles, "Sure glad there ain't no Japs from Texas." As the Johnson's guns continue, 18 rounds a minute, Hagen is dumbstruck with joy as the enemy changes course. And Evans is so elated himself that, according to Hagen, he can scarcely speak. He struts across the bridge saying, "Now I've seen everything." But the Johnston has no way out of this now. She's surrounded by enemy ships and has earned their full attention. She suffers vicious bombardment. One of her forward mounts takes a direct hit, gun 52, and everybody's either killed or critically wounded. Fires break out in the magazine below, filling the upper handling room with smoke and making the bridge even all but untenable. Smoke from these fires flows up and engulfs Bob Hagen and his Mark 37 gun director. "Our eyes were streaming and we were coughing and choking as we carried out our duties," he said. "We are now in the position where all the guts and gallantry in the world couldn't save us. We knew we could not survive, but we figured that help for the carriers must be on the way, and every minute's delay might count. This was the emblem of sacrifice, buying time. Our lives don't matter. Our ship may die, but they will not catch the carriers whose protection is our duty." Now, Evans has decamped the stern to command the ship from the emergency steering station at this point. He's relaying course changes down a hatch to the steering engine room. And some of the ship survivors will actually credit the fact that they lived for this erratic course as the Johnston is throwing the rudder, still trying to chase splashes on one engine, on a manually operated rudder, on Norwegian steam as the crew are throwing their shoulders into the ram that turns the rudder. The ship is rather clumsy. They'll actually credit their survival to the fact that Japanese are looking at this target and saying, what on earth is it doing? But the Japanese are close now. They're about 6,000 yards away. And two other ships of Taffy 3 at this point are giving their last full measure. The Hoel, battered by as many as 40 shells, goes down about 8:40. More than 80% of her 325-man crew are killed in action. A salvo of battleship shells has gutted the Samuel B. Roberts, opening up her side plating to the point where a semi-trailer could fit through it. The Japanese get the range on Sprague's carriers as well. Around this time, the Gambier Bay takes a hit, loses an engine, falls out of formation, and is enveloped and surrounded and sunk. Now, in the midst of this, there comes a rare sort of moment in naval warfare. Normally, sea battles are fought at great ranges, the actors encapsulated within massive steel machines. Human operators seldom glimpse one another. But now, as the Johnston passes by the wounded Samuel B. Roberts, we have this from the skipper of the Roberts, Lieutenant Commander Robert Copeland. Copeland is heartbroken to see what's become of Evan's ship, and he tells us this. The Johnston went by, limping along at slow speed, and I saw her captain. He was a very big man with coal-black hair. His name was Evans. I'd met him at some of those conferences. He was standing on the fantail conning his ship by calling down through an open scuttle hatch into the steering engine room. I can see him now. He was stripped to the waist and was covered with blood. His left hand was wrapped in a handkerchief. And as he went by, he wasn't over 100 feet from us as he passed us on our starboard side. And he turned a little and waved his hand at me. Captain Copeland would never see Evans again. For almost 2 hours now, the Johnston has waged a futile effort to keep Vice Admiral Takeo Kurita's ships from overtaking Sprague's carriers. But now it seems nothing remains to be done. Two Japanese heavy cruisers are on the verge of pinching off Taffy 3's southward flight. But something extraordinary is about to happen. Admiral Kurita is in the midst of a deep fatigue. He's been in combat for nearly 72 hours straight. And as time goes on, the air attacks intensify. Taffy 2 starts getting her TBFs loaded with armor-piercing bombs and torpedoes, and they lay themselves into these two cruisers. As 9 o'clock approaches, two of the cruisers are dead in the water and sinking, Chokai and Chikuma, victims of air attack and surface gunfire both, it seems. Kurita's destroyers are getting strafed relentlessly by these Wildcat fighter pilots who strafe, circle back around, strafe again, out of ammunition, circle around, make dummy runs, more dummy runs. The dummy runs force the Japanese captains to change course, constantly compromising their speed and pursuit through course changes. The Japanese commanders are constantly exaggerating the size of the American ships, destroyers or cruisers, jeep carriers or fleet carriers. The hull in the Gambier Bay are down, Samuel B. Roberts soon to follow, Johnston dead in the water. Admiral Kurita issues an order to his far-flung squadron. Rendezvous, my course north, speed 20. The Japanese are going home. Now a signalman on the jeep carrier Fanshawe Bay, seeing the silhouettes becoming smaller, exclaims, "Damn it, boys, they're getting away." And Ernest Evans' ship, the first into the fight, will be the last of them to die. As she slows to a stop amid the final salvos from the enemy, there comes now an impact so severe, the crew thinks she's hit a marine obstruction. There's a terrible sensation of being lifted and shaken violently, and this hit to the after engine room has knocked the electrical switchboard dead. The Johnston's sprint through hell has ended, and the ship, powerless, begins coasting to its final resting place. Pacific currents take over the work of the Johnston's engines. Captain Evans passes the order to abandon ship. She was a vehicle suitable only for the dead. On the main deck, on the port side amidships, lay a pile of people half of them gone. Some sailors were still carrying wounded out from below deck spaces, laying them out in the open in the hope they might get some medical assistance or at least some fresh air, some relief from the exhaustion of the foregoing 2 hours. Captain Evans leaves the fantail and walks forward toward the ward room where Lieutenant Brown is still tending to wounded. Evans tries to persuade him to go over the side, but Brown won't hear of it. There are still wounded on the ship whose lives are hanging in the balance. The doctor feels he can do that work better on the ship's own decks. He'll use what time he has left productively. Now, Bob Hagen, way up there in the gun director, was slow to get word to abandon ship. Like a man in a dream, very carefully and leisurely, he takes off his shoes, goes over the rail, and swims. In the water, he looks back, and he sees the entrance to the ward room. He sees Lieutenant Brown carrying somebody from the outside deck back into the ward room, and there's a whistling rush and an explosion. A Japanese shell hitting right where Brown had just gone inside, and Hagen breaks down finally after all this time and sobs. And the Johnston's final sacrifice to save Sprague's carriers is to serve as a static target for Japanese gunners who doubtlessly at this point long to sink anything with an American flag on it. Thus far, they'd really only gotten the Gambier Bay. Five other little jeeps had lumbered south, improbably still afloat. The Cullinan Bay took 15 hits from cruiser main battery rounds and carried on at full speed. 15 hits. Most of them punched straight through. But the Johnston's defiance is at an end. She's parried and riposted gallantly, but she would not get away. Captain Evans, in his decision-making, had ensured that she wouldn't. Now, what fate befell the legendary captain himself is the subject of disagreement and conjecture among the survivors. Bob Socher, sailor on board the ship, was among the last to see him. The motor machinist mate, having gone aft to take his turn cranking the rudder pump, returned forward to fight fires. And as he walks toward the bow, there's a terrible blinding flash. He's knocked unconscious, regains his senses, finds himself covered in blood, Bob Socher, and realizing that the abandoned ship order has been given, he heads back to the fantail again to jump in the water. The freeboard's less back there. You can jump in a little easier. He wrote, "I went aft as Captain Evans went forward. With neither one of us saying a word to the other, we passed by, staring blankly at one another." Some claim to have seen the Johnston skipper climbing over the rail into a motor whaleboat that he'd ordered released. Others weren't so sure he made it into the boat. And if he did, in all likelihood, he didn't go far. The damage to that craft was considerable from all the gunfire. It's been written that so much of life is preparation, so much routine, and so much retrospect, that the purest essence of anyone's genius contracts itself in life to a precious few hours. The window opened by circumstance on the genius and bravery of Captain Evans for 2.5 hours on this morning was once again closed. They called him the Chief at Annapolis. The Chief, the Cherokee warrior, unhorsed by enemy gunfire, was lost to the whirlwind, taken to a private oblivion that to this day burnishes his mystique and deepens the legend of his ship and his magnificent crew. The battle is over. The Japanese are withdrawing. Kamikazes will soon arrive. They'll take down another jeep carrier, the USS St. Lo. And a three-day-long ordeal at sea awaits the survivors of all this as they contend with sharks and exposure and dehydration sickness. Five ships are down. Accountability for this fiasco that brought all this about will never quite be delivered at the flag level. The Battle of Samar is both the greatest upset victory in the history of our Navy and also one of its most embarrassing moments. Even though no action was taken against him, Admiral Halsey, his historic reputation was certainly never the same after this episode. Leaving escort carrier task units to defend the beachhead against the main body of the Japanese fleet. Controversy would rage, but within the closed confines of the Pentagon and at Pearl Harbor. Admiral Nimitz knew how costly public controversy was. He kept a lid on the laundry. There are so many superlatives we can attach to this battle. It was first and foremost the greatest upset victory in our own Navy's history, maybe any Navy's history. It was the first time a U.S. aircraft carrier was sunk by enemy gunfire, the first and only time the great Yamato fired her main battery in anger at a U.S. ship. The battle marked Japan's first use of suicide planes. It was the first and last time destroyers engaged heavy cruisers and battleships 30 times their size in broad daylight, in close gun range, and got the better of them. It was the last surface action ever fought, actually. But the real story, amidst all these superlatives, remains the people. The prevailing humility of its participants always struck me, truly. They say, the way they described it, what they did was to them on that day no different than any other destroyer crew in the fleet would have done. And they are very serious about this point. They are absolutely ordinary and unremarkable. They say they did what any sailor would have done. You ask any of them about their particular task on that ship, on any of the ships, and they'll tell you this. Now, what I realized talking to them was that there are two types of greatness. There is revealed greatness, and then there's the unrevealed kind. We can call it potential greatness. This view of heroism as ordinary and common opens to us all the possibility that these attributes of heroism and bravery lie within each of us, waiting to be revealed by circumstance. Accordingly, I think this story is just a feast for midshipmen and those who instruct them. It's a feast for all of us, even those like me who have never served in uniform. All of us have to figure out what we'll do with this thing. Ernest Evans has handed us a burden, I suppose. The burden is to wonder what we'll do with his example. For history, as we'll soon see further later today, is a living thing. History is what you did yesterday. You become a historic figure the moment your deeds can be talked about in the past tense. History is how people tell that story tomorrow, just as we're telling Ernest Evans' story today. No school, staff, college, or training command will tell you how to be Ernest Evans. Until DARPA's brain scientists finally break the code, the U.S. Navy finally stands up ComNav Hero Pack, we'll be left to ponder quietly and alone what our truest and highest capabilities might be. Ernest Evans stands as an inspiration to ponder. I doubt he would have wanted us to see him as some kind of daunting, towering figure whose example should intimidate us into uncertainty or self-doubt. I rather think he'd be entertained by those things, too, along the way to becoming the Navy's greatest fighting captain this side of Stephen Decatur. May his story never be forgotten. Take in his example, and please try to make it the history of you. Thank you very much.
How about that? Yeah, I got to thank Mike Marletto for that. That was what I was thinking of yesterday, and I get the two ships confused. We were talking about the Samuel B. Roberts, and but I knew that in my head, right, there was a story about a Native American guy who received the Medal of Honor, and the captain of the Samuel B. Roberts is a guy named Copeland, and he's awarded the Navy Cross, and he lives. And I thought, well, geez, how did I screw that up? But What a story, huh? Yeah. What a story. Yeah. So anyway, we have to do shithole weather. Yeah. So on the backside of that, you know, a little bit of inspiration. And it's very interesting to hear, you know, the broader story about where the actions that day came from. How earlier in the war, he felt inept and had to run, and well, never do that again. And you know, the other thing that it reminded me of, when I did a part of my first tour after I went to First Light Armor Reconnaissance Battalion, I went from 1-5 as an infantry officer to being a a cab officer, essentially. Marine Corps doesn't call it that, but that's what it is. You know, you're light armored, and there's a whole series of missions that go with that, screen guard cover, blah, 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 blah. So anyway, I started reading about cavalry operations. I got sent to the Cav Leaders course. So I got interested in cavalry operations. Well, there's a guy, and you can't really talk about him that much in public because he ultimately, after the war, is instrumental in the founding of the Ku Klux Klan. But his name's Nathan Bedford Forrest. And if you want to read somebody who does a whole lot in the Tennessee area, Tennessee, Mississippi, right, in that area during the war, read about Nathan Bedford Forrest and what he does. And he's not a military guy, right? He's a plantation owner and slave trader by profession. And if you've heard the term first with the most, it's attributed to him. And what he did in fighting was he preyed on the other leaders' knowledge gaps and the vulnerability that a leader feels in that situation. And so it was very interesting as I developed the decision-making stuff that I developed. And you look at what, you know, Nathan Bedford Forrest does against routinely formations that are larger than his, that are much larger than his, and they wind up surrendering or are routed from the battlefield. And what does he do? As soon as he sees them, he would look at his bugler and say, and it didn't matter what size they were, sound the charge. And he would lead it. And off they would go. And they never, ever hesitated into the fight. You know, violence of action and speed were both weapons. And so the impression, you're right, with that violent onslaught was that there must be something much bigger behind them, because surely if that's all there is, they wouldn't do that. And he would, you know, he would rule the battlefield. And so to me, you see that in this battle off of Samar, in the Japanese. Now, again, mind you, where we're at, right? You know, it's no secret to the Japanese who's winning the war. They know it, right? They heard what happened in Midway, right? How their fleet was decimated at Midway. And they've lived it. They've watched the island hopping. So anyway, so you can see that, like, I'm not sure about what exactly is going on, right? I'm not sure, you know, I know this, but I don't know this, and I'm afraid of this, and so they call off the fight. When they clearly had hours to destroy, right, a United States naval force. They did not do that. So it's an amazing story, right? So Ernest E. Evans is his name, and Mike Marletto sent me that yesterday. He said, "Look, I know that you'll be absolutely out of your mind when you listen to this. It's amazing." So if you do a search for Ernest E. Evans, you'll see a picture of him at the commissioning of the USS Johnston, and native of Pawnee, Oklahoma, graduated from the Naval Academy in 1931, as Mr. Horn Fisher said. And then ultimately made famous, you know, he's at Pearl Harbor on December 7th. And then ultimately on October 27th, 1943. Evans fought the ship gallantly until it was sunk on October 25th, 1944, by Japanese force. So again, you see in his bold action and his lack of hesitation, just the what happens to somebody who's not as sure as you are. who doesn't feel like they know what you know. So I think it's always, for me, it's always been a very interesting dynamic in dynamic decision making, right? That the leader is constantly plagued with what they don't know and the fear of losing, and that I'm better off not doing this and maintaining my force than I am pressing the issue, right? So anyway, pretty amazing story. Pretty amazing story, and a huge thank you to Mike Marletto. Got to do shithole weather. Yeah, and for that, got to have music, right? All right. From Chris in Massachusetts. He's now in Hopedale, Mass. He's working today. Yeah, that's right. I actually do have a job. It's dark, 12 degrees, looking for a high of 25. Bright and sunny skies coming. West wind sustained at 18 miles an hour, gusting to 22. Shows me the building that he's working at, and then a flock of turkeys that he says very thankful that they made it through Thanksgiving. From North Carolina, First Sergeant Wayne, 35 and sunny, looking for a high of 54 degrees with clouds rolling in this afternoon. Overnight low of 33. Cloudy all weekend with a chance of rain on Saturday, looking for highs in the upper 40s. First Sergeant Wayne. Trump basically got a 6105. That's it. Dude can still reenlist. A nice picture of Dunkin' Donuts somewhere near Hickory, North Carolina. Mac, just heard yesterday's weather. Hickory, North Carolina is a town. It's 59 miles west of Charlotte. The North Carolina license plate office is where you get your car license plate or renew the old one instead of going to the DMV. Got it. Now I understand. And now I know where Hickory is. I hadn't looked it up. From Churchbridge. Everybody knows where Churchbridge now, right? Yeah, north of Minot, 200 miles. Unusually warm up by midnight tonight for the final shopping weekend before Christmas. It will be enjoyed, but it might challenge highway drivers as pavement frost merges with the warmer temperatures. Currently, it's clear and 5 degrees above with a 12-mile-an-hour wind out of the south. Afternoon high and under a mix of sun and clouds will be 23. Winds out of the southeast at 22. While heading out of town for my doctor's appointment yesterday, I spotted this jolly character. And it looks like about a 20-foot-tall Santa. Those blow-up things? Yeah, you put the air compressor outside? And you put that son of a bitch in your front yard? Yeah, how about that? From Nancy? TGIF in Pleasantville. It's sunny and 18 degrees. On the way to a balmy 31. Overnight low of 21. Winds are out of the east at 5 and calm. Erie is sunny and 27. Beach weather. Here's a pic from the charter school today. Beautiful sunny day in western Pennsylvania. Looks pretty. Snow on the ground, so it's cold. Good morning, Matt. Today's weather in beautiful Vacaville, California. 49 degrees. Foggy. Winds out of the south-southeast at 6. Have a great day. And a picture of from the fog outside of the window of his, I don't know, it looks like the mirror of a truck. I'm not exactly sure if Dave's got a truck or a sedan. All right, that's a look at your shithole weather. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Montana Man joins me, pinch hitting. Montana is the Almarin Radio chef understudy. So, and he's a legit foodie. You're going to hear his credentials if you haven't heard him. And, and we'll talk about Montana Man's. First of all, you'll hear about his life a little bit. He's been to the dentist like 4 times this week. Yeah, so he got that going for him. So you'll hear about that, and as we talk food eventually. So whatever you do, don't touch that dial. More Balmering Radio coming up right here on your home for it. And yes, I will put the link to that. It's a video that Mr. James Hornfisher, who's the author of a couple books, right? Neptune's Inferno, which is the United States Navy at Guadalcanal, Ship of Ghosts, about the USS Houston, and The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors. So, Mr. Hornfisher, you heard that. I'll put that link in the post for hour one. More Balmering Radio coming up, right? A Christmas edition. And I'm telling you, watch It's a Wonderful Life, man. Watch it. It's a good flick. More Balmering Radio coming up next. Watch the 4K colorized version, right? It's different. More Balmering Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. Merry Christmas.
More than 2 million Americans have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that approximately 11 to 20% of those warriors may have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. As we recognize PTSD Awareness Month, Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my command and unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit veteranscrisisline.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Mac, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.